the contamination that they found, chromium 6 and
hexavalent chromium, yeah.
Yeah, so there's a variety of these chromiums, some of which are more harmful than others. What is it about that material? How is it produced? What is it a kind of a byproduct of? And should we be concerned, as sort of within the UK, is that commonly found within any of your investigations?
Chromium is just a metal. Any decent classic car's bumpers, if they're being looked after, will be really shiny chromium. All metals are neutral. So if you've got an iron fork or something and you put your hand on it, you're touching something that's neutral. In order to be a salt, something like sodium chloride, the stuff you might put on your fish and chips this evening, then electrons are lost and gained. Chromium traditionally loses 3 electrons. And if you go into your back garden and dig up your clay soil, you'd find chromium in it.
Stay tuned to hear more about common sources of contamination, as well as learning how to identify and contain them.
At Central Piling, we have a fleet of continuous flight auger, rotary board and driven rigs of various sizes. This caters for most piling and retaining wall needs. Our team's technical, logistical and operational strengths provide clients with a flexible and reliable design and build solution across England and Wales. We pride ourselves on understanding the environment within which we work and being a responsible contractor. To ensure greater efficiency and meet our growth targets, we are always developing our people, plant and services. We now offer a plant and operator hire service, including ancillary equipment. For more details, please visit centralpiling.com or phone 01787 474 000. That's 01787 474 000.
Welcome to today's edition of the Breaking Ground podcast. I'm joined by Paul Nathaniel from Land Quality Management, Ian Evans from Arcadis, and Carrie Rose from Atkins. Hello to you all. First question, I suppose it's to each of you, so we'll start with Paul, is you were on the specialist in land condition register, SILC, but are you an engineer? Are you a scientist? Are you a geologist? What's your background? How would you describe yourself to fellow professionals?
I'm intrigued by the question because you've differentiated scientist and geologist. Might come back to that.
It's a bit of a catch-all, isn't it, I suppose, scientist?
I'm a chartered geologist. I did a pure geology degree and then followed that up with a master's in engineering geology. So I'm a chartered geologist, I'm a European geologist, and I'm also a specialist in land condition, a SILC, which is a professional qualification beyond chartered.
Okay, so similar to ROGEP, would you say?
Very similar to the Register of Ground Engineering Professionals, who have a particular subcategory for contaminated land. SILC is broader than just the LC stands for land condition. So it's broader than land contamination, but it's broadly equivalent, yes.
So why would that exist when ROGEP also exists? Those two kind of separate entities?
ROGEP's the Johnny come lately to the party.
That was it. Excellent.
But the other more pertinent answer is that SILC is deliberately like a big mature tree. You've got deep roots in your profession, geology in my case, but then you branch out and you interface with other professions, with chemistry, with chartered surveyors, with environmental health, with environmental lawyers. So it's that multidisciplinarity that SILC has chosen to test and recognize through the qualification of SILC.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, Carrie, can I ask you the same question? What's your background?
So I think I would say I probably fit more within the definition of scientist. So my educational background's more environmental chemistry, soil science, rather than the pure geology. Obviously, definitely done some geology. And then through work, I would say I'm maybe 20% engineer by osmosis, because I've sat in lots of ground engineering teams, worked obviously on lots of civil engineering projects. So I quite like the mashup between engineering and science that comes into what we do, actually the practical application of chemistry and science to the ground. So that's how I would describe myself, which is possibly quite a niche thing to be, but it works for me.
Ian?
Yep, so I'm, again, something slightly different. So by degree, I'm an environmental scientist. So some would say the new geography or the old geography, however you want to go at it. I am chartered through CyWEM, which is the Chartered Institute of Water and Environmental Management. I'm also a member of the Royal Society of Chemistry. And I would describe myself as a geoenvironmental scientist with no hyphen on the geo, which is a completely made-up word in our industry, which fundamentally means I dabble in an element of geotechnics, but really it's engineering geology, and that's a whole other world of conversation, and an element of then contaminated land. So in our industry, you have people that look at pure contaminated land, and then people like me that also do geoenvironmental, which tends to be around the regeneration piece.
Excellent. Right, let's get stuck in now to the investigation, geoenvironmental investigation. First question is, who's defining what is contaminated lands? How do you know that you need to investigate something? Where do we start with this all? Ian, would you like to handle that one?
So my angle always tends to be, so I would suggest that about 90% of all contaminated land appraisal in the UK is probably driven through the planning regime. Historically, it was more under Part 2A of the Environmental Protection Act. So planning is all about assessment of a site with regard to its proposed end use, so its future use. And Part 2A is around the appraisal of a site's suitability for use under its current use. So they're the two key drivers. But when we talk about regeneration, most regeneration is driven through the planning regime, albeit through different facets of that. So that can be through sort of like DCOs for some of the large-scale stuff, some through Acts of Parliament, etc. But certainly most of it is driven through planning. And it's essentially there is a great set of guidance, and that's the key bit, it's always guidance, and that we always refer to, which is LCRM, as delivered out by the environment. I knew you were going to ask me that one.
You mentioned DCOs as well, which I was going to ask.
Development Consent Order.
Okay. So within that, the government would already know whether there's a risk that land is contaminated, or is it just saying, right, these sorts of developments, you're going to need to do some sort of geoenvironmental investigation.
Yeah. So the fundamental of it is contaminated land, which is the environmental bit of the geo, that needs to be assessed under planning. So that is a material planning consideration that you need to go and assess to be able to determine whether the site in its current and or future use is suitable. So you would do that. So LCRM, by the way, is Land Contamination Risk Management. It's all condition contamination. And that takes you through a process of appraisal. So we start at a high level with a phase one best study, which is exactly the same as you would do for a geotechnical purpose. So we start off in exactly the same route when we do contaminated land and or geoenvironmental. Then we slightly turn right or left, depending on which way you want to go, and geotechnical engineers go the other way. So there is a fundamental similarity in how we approach the appraisal of a site. So there is no difference, even down to the appraisal of a ground model and a conceptual site model. They are fundamentally the same thing, but appraised in a slightly different way.
Carrie, with a geotechnical investigation, for instance, there's a certain number of boreholes that have to be carried out given the size of the buildings that are being constructed, the plan area, the potential depth of the foundations. Do similar principles apply within contaminated land investigations?
Yeah, but perhaps not as clear cut. So I think maybe those definitions that you've mentioned there are laid out quite nicely in the Eurocode 7, I think the ground engineering people follow, where you've got, for this building type, you need this type of ground investigation. So ours would be, and I think maybe sometimes much to the irritants of our ground engineering colleagues, slightly more grey. So our ground investigation, we obviously, there's British standards and guidance that we follow. But yeah, we're very much basing it on what the ground conditions could be in terms of geology, what the conceptual site model is, who's going to use it, what's the previous use. So you end up generally, I would say most projects that come through planning, you end up with your site, you'll have general coverage based on what you've got access to, because maybe there's already a building there. And then you might have some targeted investigation. For example, you had below ground tanks in the past, for example. So you end up with quite a, statistically speaking, random stratified approach to the ground investigation. So it's certainly not as clear cut as for this end use, you need this number of locations, which is why it's important to really get people that understand how to design ground investigation at the beginning. I think looking back a couple of decades when I first started out, I think people maybe used to, because part 2A that Ian mentioned, the guidance for contaminated land assessment at the time, or still now, but came out in 2000 when I first started. I think there's a lot of people kind of dabbling in how to approach ground investigation for contaminated land. And the industry's moved on since then, which is a good thing. It's not something to dabble in, I don't think.
Yeah, well, Paul, that must make it really tough when you're bidding for work, because you'll make a proposal to a client to say, right, this is my estimate for the contaminated land investigation. But if somebody else just has a completely different scope because they feel that they can compromise on certain elements, whether it be particular contaminants or the depth range of those contaminants, then it could put you at a significant commercial disadvantage. Do you see those challenges day to day in your work?
If you go back to your original question of who defines contaminated land, the legally correct answer is the local authority. Everything else that we do under planning isn't really looking at contaminated land in a strict legal sense. We're looking at land contamination. And so if you go back to the LCRM guidance that Ian referred to, the first thing you do is a qualitative risk assessment. So Carrie talked about random stratified sampling. Imagine you've gone to your GP and they say, I really need to take a blood sample. I'm going to have to put a needle into you. And they start playing battleships and just stabbing you at random in the hope they might find the vein that they're going to take the blood out of. You might not feel too happy. But if they kind of feel with their hands and they work out where the veins are, then there's a greater chance that the first stab is the wrong word. they should draw blood. So the qualitative risk assessment looks at all the historical stuff that you know about the site that Carrie and Ian have talked about, the geology, previous land uses, that kind of stuff. And that gives you a feel for what kind of geology you've got and what kind of contaminants are going to be present and where you think they are most likely to be found. So you then design your site investigation by saying, I need so many boreholes, each of which can be justified. And at each borehole, I'm going to go down to these depths, justified. And I'm going to test for these substances, again, with a fully justified reason as to why I'm spending my client's money. So in the scenario you've asked me, if the client says to me, just design me a site investigation, and I say, well, what are your criteria for choosing your successful tender? And so we're going to go for the cheapest. I say, thank you very much indeed. Have a nice life. If they actually say, well, actually, we're looking for the solution to the problem because we need to get planning permission, build our buildings and make loads of money and retire to Barbados or wherever it is developers retire to, then you've got a chance to put in a, this is what you know, the conceptual site model that Ian talked about, within which you also say what you don't know. So your site investigation is to resolve the things you don't know but need to know to assess the risk and then decide what kind of remediation you're going to do. And on that basis, Ian or Carrie might beat me because they come in with a cheaper price but an equally good design. Or I might win because I'd choose a slightly different configuration. But we're all answering the same question and justifying why we are asking our client to dip their hands into their pockets and pay us.
But presumably, being silt registered will at least create a level playing field to an extent in terms of there's a way that things should be done, and there'll be things within the sort of silt register auditing period that sort of
recognises that you guys know what you're doing.
so we would certainly look. I mean, what Silk and sort of particularly SQP, so suitably qualified and experienced person, would also drive is competency. And what you hear a lot of in our industry is competency. So in terms of, and just taking up on Paul's comment there about the ground investigation and an element of carries, is, design of a ground investigation, and this is not exact figures, is about 50% true science, 25% know-how, and about 25% just gut feel and wizardry. When it comes to it, we have to do a very weird thing in our industry, and this is the one that always takes some explanation, because we have to go out and prove a negative, which is quite different in what we do. Because if we went and investigated all of the areas of gross contamination within a site and came back and said, all of those areas on your site are really, 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 really horrible and it's going to cost you this, nobody in the long run is going to thank us, because there's probably the other 90% of the site that is suitable for use and relatively needs little to nothing done. So we quite regularly, when we design a ground investigation, have to be spatially sort of spread in our scope to be able to prove that negative, which is very different, I think. That's where we slightly differ to the geotechnical aspect of ground investigation. Where I'm working cross-industry with geotechnical engineers, engineering geologists, my first play on it is, you go show where you want to put your boreholes and why, and then we'll move on from there.
What I see is that the real value in what you do is avoiding further problems down the line, whether it be kind of limitation of remedial costs and delays, or health issues more concerningly for the end user. And it's really there where I want to take the next part of the conversation. I'm really keen to learn more about common hazards in the ground that we find. And one of the ways that we thought when we were preparing for this podcast that we could do that was to illuminate some of the examples there are within popular culture about history of contaminated land. So without trivializing the topics, we're going to talk about some films that listeners might be familiar with, and the hazards that were found on those sites. We'll start with one that's one of my favourite films, and for the listening to the sports news this week, also Pep Guardiola's, given that his keenness for Julia Roberts, and that of course is Erin Brockovich. So Erin, famously, and a lot you'd be familiar with her work, was a paralegal within a law practice in America, and she investigated some groundwater contamination in California. I don't know which one of you guests is most familiar with this story, but I mean it's a really powerful story and great testament to Erin's hard work. It's a true story. Erin's still very active in environmentalism. He'd like to come on and talk a little bit about the story and kind of maybe dispel some of the myths around it.
I had to look back. I did actually just look back to see when that film came out, because I knew it had been a while ago, but I couldn't quite remember. And it was the year 2000.
Was that?
Yeah. Which is just as I was finishing my degree. And I was thinking that there was one scene in that movie in particular that I remembered where when they go to do the ground investigation, it's almost like a army command center. So they're doing the ground investigation and there's drilling rigs everywhere and there's tents and there's computer screens and it's almost, maybe there's a helicopter, I don't know, but they've got like this whole army command center approach to ground investigation going on. And that stuck, I remember at the time that stuck in my head, like, oh wow, like that's contaminated land investigation. And then obviously I went to do my first ever ground investigation supervision by myself in a field with a drilling rig, and none of that happened. So first of all, I felt like I wasn't missold. No, so that was that was definitely like in the film, you know, that was, it was really serious. And
it was quite a contrast, so, to Erin doing her own investigation with a jam jar and a jiffy bag.
in the water. Yeah. And I think that stuck in my head, for sure. And then I think what it did do, and sorry, maybe not answering the question, but I think anything that I guess brings these serious matters into the consciousness of people that don't work in the area is, I think that's just excellent. I think environmental protection and a way of communicating these issues to people is excellent. And obviously nothing bigger than a movie to do that. So I think at the time it was really well received. I think something else that maybe stuck in my mind is that they didn't have consultants. I think they went straight from concern to scientist and
academics.
And then obviously it was based on real life events and a successful real life case, and I guess a film probably couldn't capture that in reality, the length of times those things take. And also in a film they quite easily go from what they see as like correlation to causation, and I think in real life that's really, really difficult. So we'll see correlation, but it's difficult to prove causation. But in a film, that's quite easy to do. So, they're my main thoughts on that one.
Yeah. So they did show, I think it was a farm, and the animals had died, and there was cancers within some of the families, and of course it was in close proximity to this Pacific Gas and Electric Company.
Yes.
The contamination that they found, chromium 6 and
hexavalent chromium.
So there's a variety of these chromiums, some of which are more harmful than others. What is it about that material? How is it produced? What is it a kind of a byproduct of? And should we be concerned, as sort of within the UK, is that commonly found within any of your investigations?
Chromium is just a metal. Any decent classic car's bumpers, if they're being looked after, will be really shiny chromium. All metals are neutrals. If you've got an iron fork or something and you put your hand on it, you're touching something that's neutral. In order to be a salt, something like sodium chloride, the stuff you might put on your fish and chips this evening, then electrons are lost and gained. Chromium traditionally loses 3 electrons, and if you go into your back garden and dig up your clay soil, you tested it, you'd find chromium in it, but it'll be chromium 3+. Just occasionally, for particular industrial purposes, we strip another 3 electrons off and you end up with chromium 6+, which is what the issue at Hinkley was at the PG&E site. And that is a very strong oxidizing agent. It doesn't like being 6+. It's desperately looking for 3 electrons to go to the Cr3+. So that's what makes chromium 6+ rare and reactive, and therefore harmful to, amongst other things, human health. So it is rare.
But it's
expected and predictable. So I'll let Ian talk about where we might find it.
So I was going to come at more from a... Personally, I always take the view that there are contaminants everywhere. You go into coal mining areas, you will have arsenic, you will have lead, you will have all of these things everywhere. I'm always really wary in our industry because, you know, people hear the word contamination, contaminants, and it can be quite sort of concerning to people. So my thing is they are all there, and where we have a slight difference in the UK is you can have contamination within your site, but it does not mean that your site is contaminated. And it is quite rare that you will only have one contaminant that drives that site in terms of concern. So it's all around that suitability for you. So I'm always a bit loath to get into the specifics. Not because we don't understand the specifics, but because that going out to members of the public and talking about specific contaminants can be really emotive. in our industry, because we all get asked the questions, you know, does that mean I've got to grow an extra limb? Does it mean this? Does it mean that? So we're always looking at that suitability for use and how do we protect people? And, you know, the fundamentals are asbestos is around us. Metals are around us. Organics are around us. We live with them day in, day out. It's whether they're present at a form and or type and concentration that can cause harm within the context of that site and linking that back to the conceptual model. So it doesn't answer the question you asked about the chromium, but it's really that it's rare that we get into a specific that we can know that is the specific contaminant that's causing harm.
It's from metal. It can be naturally occurring. Obviously, metals are found within the ground anyway, but is it more realistically to be found in areas where there's been some sort of refinery and this brownfield site? Would you ever, for instance, find problems in the ground that are hazardous to health where it is a greenfield site? Is there just naturally occurring elements within the ground that we should be wary of? Radon perhaps might be an example.
There are absolutely naturally occurring areas of elevated chemistry. But what I would say is you've probably got to go and munch an awful lot of it for it to be shown to cause any harm in the UK. You know, which is why we always look at sort of like pick a child in terms of, you know, the children that are going in soil. But when you look at the extremes that are modelled in those appraisals and how much soil they eat, you've really got to ask yourself, whoever the parent is of that child that's munching all that soil, they're really not watching them. And I am not saying that I'm a great parent, but I think I'd like to say I'd notice
we're
if
not
my son
judge.
Was eating soil. No, thankfully.
You are right, though. Radon is a very good example of a natural hazard that kills thousands of people every year in this country through lung cancer.
Right.
So absolutely spot on. The other one, which is another gas, is methane that naturally comes out of areas of either historic coal mining or areas where you've still got coal and other such organic deposits in the ground. So yes, there are dangerous levels of other contaminants, but as Ian said, mostly natural soil chemistry isn't too much of an issue.
Yeah.
On the kind of greenfield side that you referred to.
I had no idea that the fatalities in terms of radon were as high as that. I knew about the issue, but that's quite concerning. Funny, Ian should mention about eating soil. I remember at university, they used to talk about taking samples of soil and rubbing them on your teeth to look at the... I presume that's no longer part of the curriculum.
There are other ways of differentiating silt and clay.
Let's move on now to another film, Dark Waters, starring Mark Ruffalo. Mark was in Foxcatcher, probably his most famous role. He's a big environmentalist himself. I must admit, it wasn't a film that I was familiar with, fairly recently released, but really enjoyed it. This centres on the case of DuPont and their kind of wonder material, Teflon. It completely passed me by that there was any issues at all with Teflon. It says, doing a bit of investigation, there has been a lot of concerns about that material, and certainly some of the early versions of it that was used in their products. But the focus of the film was really around the community near the DuPont plant, and similar to the Aaron Brockovich film, some of the health issues that community had. That material, perhaps somebody can help me out, PFOA carrier.
Yeah. So, okay, you've given me probably the hardest one then. So PFOA, as we might call it, perfluorooctanoic acid. So that is carbon, okay. Carbon, hydrogen, fluoride, and oxygen. So it's a molecule that's persistent in the environment, and it's sometimes referred to we've been referring to it as an emerging contaminant for more than 15 years now. I think it's emerged, and I think it's very much in everyone's consciousness now, possibly even helped by, you know, films like this, but then obviously also the case itself.
And why emerging? Why has it not been around for longer than that?
Can I just help by go back to what an emerging contaminant is? So we've talked earlier on about routine contaminants, chromium 6, arsenic, I think Ian talked about lead. These are things that we've known about and have enough scientific understanding to assess their danger and do something about it for a long time. From time to time, a new substance will come to our awareness. It might have been around for a long time, but in terms of finding it in soil and groundwater, we may not have had the analytical methods, we may not have looked, and suddenly we realize that there was an issue here, and we don't necessarily have the technical guidance that Ian was talking about earlier to deal with that particular chemical or that particular family of chemicals. So an emerging contaminant is one where the book hasn't been written yet. And in UK terms, I am currently working with three other people to write that book for the family that PFOA is a member of. 30 years ago, chlorinated solvents that you may ask us about if you mention John Travolta and Stephen Fry in another film were considered to be emerging contaminants. Tomorrow, it's probably going to be the pharmaceuticals and the personal care products that we quite liberally take and use on us. Although you haven't made us put makeup on for this podcast, for which I am very grateful. So that's the idea of an emerging contaminant.
Okay. Thank you, Paul.
That is a key component of the film, isn't it? Because they talk about how DuPont effectively created the rules for themselves because there wasn't the knowledge from the wider community. So they set the rules to say, right, this is what's acceptable. And I don't think anything had been written down for this particular contaminant, and so therefore, what is a safe level? Is that right, Karen?
Yeah, I think so. I think the regulation wasn't there is probably the right way to term it at the time. Uh-huh. So they were able to discharge at high concentrations, and as Paul said, there the more recent research on the toxicology is quite damning. Really, the concentrations are very, very small. I think it's like the most recent is maybe 0.0004 parts per trillion can have an impact on how human systems work. So at that, even a very low concentration, so there's research in Europe and America that even at those very small concentrations, so only just detectable by the laboratories, you start to see an impact on things like how well immunizations work in children, so how the body would react to that, and then how good your liver function is. So we're not going straight, like the movies, we're not going straight from that's in the groundwater, carcinogenic cancer. It's not as clear cut as that. I think it's almost, to me, it seems more worrying that even at tiny concentrations, the impacts that they can have on human systems and allowing just the human body to function correctly. And I saw a talk on this recently, a guy gave a talk, and so you mentioned Teflon, and I had a friend who saw that film recently, and she contacted me and said, I've thrown all of my frying pans out now.
I was just going to ask, do I need to go down the kitchen?
So you can throw your frying pans out, you can throw your waterproof jacket out, but the guy, it was a statistician, was giving us this information recently, and this really hit home with me. But he said, you know, you might go up to a sandwich vendor or something in the street, and they take out a bit of greaseproof paper covered in a substance which contains PFOA, wrap your sandwich in it, and it's in there for like, I don't know, 30, you pay for it, eat it, so it's in there for maybe a minute, depending on how fast you eat, and then that goes in the bin. So for the sake of keeping your sandwich dry and warm for 1 minute, all of that concentration of PFOA is now in the environment for hundreds of years, and that just, you know, on a scale of the rest of society, I just thought, oh my God, what are we doing? What have we done? You know, and that's just one element. I mean, it's used everywhere. So yeah, I think in our industry, I think we're all very concerned about this, which is why people like Paul are trying to get guidance and how we deal with it now. It's here, it exists, how do we deal with it now?
Yeah, I'm really interested in that. What precautions should we be taking? What advice would you have for, you know, for your sandwiches or for your friends that are doing their cooking? Should we look at alternative methods of food preparation and storage?
If you want my advice, live your life. And just think about it and think about what's around. I think if you forget contamination and just think about the wider environment, I mean, that is what Kerry said there is exactly correct. The question there is, do you need it? Not. Should you try and come up with something else? We've come up with great ways of having things in our lives we don't necessarily need. But the truth of it is, I'm sort of a big believer, I'm going off on one here, so a big believer in yin and yang.
Oh, we encourage that.
Oh, no, no. Big believer in yin and yang. Because the truth of it is, you know, one concentration of a contaminant to one person is harmful. The same concentration to another person is not. So I take my hat off to people like Paul that can go out and engage their brains into this stuff. You know, I deal with conceptualization. It's you know, it's that type of thing and the fundamentals of risk and how we deal with these things. But the truth of it is, you know, the people that go and do the great work about, you know, looking at, and fundamentally, we do not just assess to a number. We assess to risk and likelihood. We're looking at different geological formations, different mannerisms in which the contaminants can act. So it's fundamentally more than just how we act and live.
Yeah, you watch something like the Seaspiracy and you look at the food chain and you think about how plastics, for instance, can get into fish, and I'm vegan, so I'm not going to have that that problem. But, you know, you think actually how big an impact will that ultimately have on human health, you know, put aside the health of animals. There is an impact, even if it's not a direct impact on our well-being, which we've got to be really conscious of.
You just go back to your frying pans and the Teflon stuff. So Teflon is a brand name for PTFE, polytetrafluoroethylene. And I am no DIY expert, but if I have to fix a leaking tap at home, I may go and buy some thin, really thin white tape and wrap it around the thread and hope that that will stop the water. That is PTFE, which is made of lots of tiny molecules of ethylene, which is a gas, stuck together, which gives it the poly bit. So you stick loads of them together. PFOA, the C8 in dark waters, was an additive used in the manufacture of polytetrafluoroethylene, the kind of stuff that makes frying pans non-stick. And the danger with your frying pans is if the coating begins to flake off, then that's time to get a new frying pan.
Okay.
And I don't see how you could possibly do this in a domestic hob, you take it to above a really high temperature, then again, it begins to thermally break down. We're talking about the high hundreds of centigrade. But there is something interesting about the PFOA and the broader PFAS, which is the kind of family, in contrast to your earlier question about greenfield sites. Nature has not made a single molecule of PFAS. So every single PFOA molecule that exists on the planet was made in a factory somewhere in the world. So it is in an entirely man-made contaminant.
It's all my fault.
It's all your fault.
Is it right, Paul, that there's now nowhere on Earth where it isn't found? So it's everywhere, Arctic, subarctic.
Yeah. If by every
environment,
it's kind of
every tribe.
Yeah. It's found in rainwater. It's found in the Arctic ice pack. It's found in polar bears. It's found in sea spray in northern Finland, far away from any industrial activity or human activity. I haven't been everywhere, but
it wasn't you. I wasn't blaming
it wasn't
you for.
And Ian is obviously better to travel than you and I are. But it is pretty much anywhere we have looked as a bunch of scientists, it has been found at detectable level. Yeah,
it's depressing, isn't it? Because you know, how do you clean this mess up. You know, we talk about the plastic problem. All right, there's measures out there, and there's these amazing vessels now that are clearing up plastic, but they're not clearing up plastic anywhere near as fast as we're producing the stuff. I think Earth needs a fundamental reset on how we live our lives to not contaminate it in that way. And talking of oceans, really is the where I want to go with the next film that I want to discuss, which is Deepwater Horizon. Of course, the Mark Wahlberg film. By the way, I don't think I've ever seen a Mark Wahlberg film where he hasn't taken his top off. I think it's supposed to be contractually obliged.
Yeah.
To do this. Carrie, have you got a favourite Mark Wahlberg film?
No,
like
sorry.
A bit of Boogie Nights.
as the only female on the call, I'm going to direct that question to someone else.
Deepwater Horizon is a very interesting tale. It's the tale of a leak, a huge release of crude oil in the Gulf of Mexico in Florida, or just off the coast, the southern coast of the United States. Politically enormously important, because of course the logo on the rig, or the company that was blamed for it, was BP. Ironically, BP merged with an American company called Amoco, and they chose to go with the name of BP, but actually it was what would have been Amoco in the past that the rig belonged to. But if you go back and look at speeches from the then president of the United States, Barack Obama, and you look at the vitriol that came across to this side of the pond because of the BP association, the punitive fines that BP faced, it was quite an interesting study.
But it was a company called Transocean that were...
They were the operators.
Yeah. Okay, so it wasn't the kit wasn't owned by them. They just operate...
There are a number of organizations involved. There are a number of contractors involved in the whole process. But ultimately, the buck literally stopped at BP.
Okay. And this, I suppose, particularly interesting for me as somebody that's drills holes in the ground for a living. The problem involved the drilling process. So it wasn't a production well, in the sense that it wasn't that they were trying to draw lots of oil out of the Gulf of Mexico. They were actually just investigating the ground. So they were just trying to see whether the site was going to be suitable for taking oil in the future. And then they were just going to cap it. So the incident actually occurred during the capping process. So they were doing a test to make sure that effectively the well was safe. And the casings that they installed, if my understanding is correct, weren't bonded correctly. And so with the upwards pressure from the oil, over time the gases escaped up to the oil rig. That then ignited something within the oil rig. The oil rig set fire. The seal was broken, and oil continued to be pumped into the Gulf of Mexico, which brings us to the issue of the contamination itself, which was I don't know what was the chemical composition.
Crude oil.
Yeah. What does that do to the marine environment, Paul?
Well, a number of things. So crude oil is what we produce: petrol, diesel, lubricating oil, the stuff that we surface our roads with. All that stuff is in the crude oil. And what happens when you get a spill, the lighter end stuff will either evaporate or dissolve. The heavier end stuff will end up as thick, gungy, tarry material that both physically and chemically is a danger. So a lot of marine life, a lot of seabed dwelling organisms suffered. The communities that survived by harvesting those kind of sea shrimps and so on also suffered enormously. At high enough levels, it's a toxic mixture of hydrocarbons, but it's also a physical problem as well.
Well, I did find a paper, it's from somebody at the Institute of Chemical Engineering in the UK,
and they were talking about the investigation into the incident there. And they said that not long before, it was only two or three months before, there was a very similar incident involving the same business in the North Sea. And so we could have been looking at a very similar situation on our shores. And just going through the details, it just seemed like there's such a high risk of this happening. They didn't completely understand exactly what had gone on. There seemed to be too many aspects that were variable and very difficult to control. And when you consider the implications, the kind of the risk against the reward, the two didn't seem to really balance for me. There's one thing, you know, obviously we're all trying to reduce carbon, but at this moment in time, it's part of our lives and the way the world operates. There's one thing doing that on land. There's a completely different thing doing it at sea. And really, I'm amazed that we're continuing in light of this, continuing to bore holes at sea and take crude oil from the seabed.
Where would you want to get your hydrocarbons from if you're not going to get them from ocean basins? I mean, we in the UK, we do have a land-based oil industry, not very much of it. Back in the 1960s, the first North Sea oil rig was called the Seagem, and it was instrumental in finding some of the early North Sea gas resources. But at Christmas, just after Christmas in the mid-1960s, in 1965, it catastrophically failed and people died. Not far from where I am in Nottingham, in Newark, near Newark, at a place called Duke's Wood, there is the onshore oil head that was constructed during the Second World War. And nearby, there's an oil museum. The guy who ran it as a retirement hobby had been on the platform at the time. The problem was that the rig had been used in warm seawater and designed for warm seawater and then brought to the North Sea. And some of the wells failed because of brittle fracture. It wasn't designed to cope with the cold waters of the North Sea, and people died as a result. Absolute tragedy. Some of the stories of some of the very young lads who were on the rig at the time and sadly died by drowning in the North Sea as the rig collapsed. But we learn from those things as engineers. We learn from those tragedies so that we don't repeat them. The lessons I think that could be learned from the Deepwater Horizon rig are: don't cut corners and make sure you've got enough redundancy so that if one component of a system doesn't do as it should do, something else can kick in. There's an element of that in the documentation that's in the public domain that suggests that wasn't necessarily the case, and that's why things got out of control. But there have been other sad tragedies in the offshore oil production business, and some really, really fortunate near misses as well, where things almost went disastrously wrong and just either by fortune or by last minute actions didn't happen. But that's not, yeah, sad. That's not restricted to offshore oil extraction.
Yeah, this is probably a really unfair question to ask, but does anybody know what percentage is onshore and offshore? I think Saudi Arabia, for instance, they've got a lot of onshore. The southern states of America have got a lot of onshore. Is it realistic to say there could be a switch?
I think whether you bore onshore or offshore, well, the fundamental of when we do, let's call it a ground investigation, you only do it because you don't know what's in the ground. So we always have to remember that when we're, you know, at the beginning of the discussions you talked about ground investigation, we only look at a small fraction of the ground and then we build up our models. But to me, the key component in all of that is we learn, we try not to repeat. So if an industry does not learn from those mistakes, sadly mistakes happen. Every industry tries to instigate all of the best HSE they can. in what they do. But fundamentally, we have to learn. And to me, whether you're doing offshore or onshore, the risks are still fundamentally there. Working offshore is obviously a lot more difficult. I couldn't do it, but it's one of those things. But the risks are still fundamentally there in terms of you are breaking ground. But is it any different? And not in terms of risk and outcome, but in your day job, if you're drilling a borehole between some made ground, going through some glacial till, going into a major aquifer, and you don't think about that and you just drill on through and you make that an open pathway.
Yeah.
Historically, people did that. Now we all know that you telescope down, you bentonite off, you seal, and you do all of those things. But we still see an industry where people may not do that. But, you know, to me, it is all about learning. I'm going to go off on one of my tangents here, so bear with me. So I'm proud to be. So I've lived in two areas that are a great industrial legacy. So I'm from Shropshire, which is the home of the Industrial Revolution. So it can be argued that it's all Shropshire's fault where we're at. I then lived for 20-odd years in the land of the Northeast, all of which is heavy contamination, all of which is what drives us as an industry. But that industry drove our heritage, drove, if you like, an aspect of our empire, but I'm not going to go into empire, but drove where we are. If we take this to sort of the longer side of should we, could we, you could argue we should never have had the Industrial Revolution, and we'd probably be in a much happier place as a globe in terms of where we're at environmentally. Yeah. But, you know, the Industrial Revolution was not wrong. People were doing it for the right reasons. Nobody's ever really, I'd like to think, gone out and knowingly said, I'm today going to go and cause a whole load of contamination.
Hopefully, well, it probably wasn't. It wasn't really in the consciousness, was it?
It's all about learning. Once we know that something causes harm, you know, we need to go look. We do need to think about longevity of things when we're thinking about new products, etc.
I think there, when you mentioned about the boreholes and potential contamination, we do a lot of sites where the ground's chalk, and of course got aquifers in the ground, and we have to look at certain things within our methodology to ensure that contaminants from the made ground aren't passed down into the aquifer. So yeah, there's certainly relevance there, whether it's offshore or onshore. I think where I was coming from when we're talking about the petroleum industry was, actually, it's just a bit easier for us to contain the effect of these disasters if we can keep it onshore. Let's just get away from a carbon-based society and look more at renewables, but we're not going to solve that one here today.
That will give us other contamination problems if in the future. The production of lithium and some of the rare earth elements has got its own issues as well.
Yeah, let's come to that, because there is a question: will you ever be out of a job? You know, if we start to remove some of these nasty industrial processes and go to green energy, what's the next problem for you? So the lithium batteries, for instance, how on earth are all these electric cars going to be disposed of? What is the plan at the moment? What's that going to do to our land? I don't know. Are we just going to end up burying all these lithium batteries in the ground? Does anybody know?
We're already burying wind turbine blades.
Well, because then they're not metal.
We can't recycle them.
Okay. What are they made of?
They're made out of alloys that you can't separate out into the raw ingredients. So we're seeing this in electronics. We're seeing a change in design. Not from minimizing the stuff that you use, but from designing them so they can be dismantled and the materials recovered and repurposed, because the shelf life of a mobile phone is 2 to 5 years. So a change in design to a whole life, a circular economy approach is what's needed. So I create something, I use it for a period of time, and then a bit like your favorite plastic brick, you can then take it apart and make something else with it. And I think if we start moving towards that kind of circular economy type of thinking, then we might avoid the waste created issues that we spend much of our time dealing with. We won't eliminate it, but it will make it a lot smaller than it is at the moment.
So bringing that back to contaminated land, that gives me a lovely spin there, Paul, thank you. Bringing me back to contaminated land, there is a big argument and discussion in our sector around sustainability. And actually a big thing that's really coming through now is you can have a site that's got contamination in it, depending on what you're looking to do, actually, should you remediate it? Because the harm you're going to cause by remediating it could be greater than that which you're trying to sort of level off and to bring that site back in. I'm not saying you don't remediate sites, but you more think about actually how do you develop that site to minimize the impact through the remediation work you do. I've got a really simple one that I use at that, where I walk in with clients. Can you tell everything I do is really simple? And I just turn around and say, well, tell me what you want to do. Ignore the contamination. What do you want to do? And 9 times out of 10, a lot of what they want to do, you can do. And actually, there's just this belief in industry that you can't do stuff because the site is brownfield or is contaminated. But most development and everything else covers sites up. Well, for most of the contamination, it's all the boring stuff that affects human health. That's the stuff that you just want to cover over. And that brings your site back to beneficial use. Groundwater is where it starts getting really funky in our industry, where we really have to start thinking about it in volatiles. But the rest of it, the form of development, can be moved and manipulated to actually mitigate most of that contamination. Because the best thing to do with contamination that's in the ground that isn't going anywhere is leave it be.
But with groundwater, obviously, there's a potential for it to be moving around. I remember a job years and years ago, probably going back 20 years, and we formed a containment barrier. It was with this soil mix column, a line of them. I can't remember the name of the product now, but they were talking about it as passive and active materials that were put in the ground to remove the contaminants from the groundwater. So it kind of, the water would come in all contaminated and then go to...
sort of permeable reactive barrier type of thing.
Yeah, so I think it was a rowing lake in Eton it was used.
Okay.
And so, yeah, it didn't contaminate the water in the rowing lake. Do you know anything about those types of products and sort of how do you see your role in interacting with other professionals within the construction industry to look at solutions?
It's exactly that I've just said. Sorry, carry on. I'll stop talking at some point. And the way where actually it's what are you going to do? So as you say, if you're putting piles in and you have an active contaminant present in the groundwater that's moving across there, can you do something as simple as a permeable reactive barrier, essentially a fancified filter or muncher? So it takes the contaminant and either traps it or it changes its chemical form as it passes through. Mother Nature, of course, has come up with all the best of those. They're called wetlands. And, you know, so it's really thinking about how do you put that into what you're going to do anyway to deal with the contamination. I'll shut up now and let Carrie get in with an issue.
I've possibly forgotten the question, but something that came to mind when Ian was speaking at length was about, so you said, you know, people, clients maybe come and they're worried about brownfield and contamination, so it's in their consciousness, right? Not so long ago, it wasn't. And so maybe we and people like or organizations like Silk have done a good job because we've been able to effectively communicate risks to people and it's in their consciousness. And so they come and talk to us about it. So I think that's a good thing, first of all. And then I was thinking of an example, a project I was working on recently. So it's a very large road bridge where there's one of the solutions is to add a carriageway to a bridge that spans a river. And there are many, many issues associated with this, top one being the structural integrity, but then many issues with building in the river around water framework directive and ecology, da 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 da. So lots and lots of issues. And I was really interested because I went to a meeting and the main contractor was there. So very early stage meeting. So every discipline was there. So you know, every single discipline. So to answer the question about which disciplines do you work with, I would say probably all of them all of the time. But the construction, the contractor had put contaminated land within his top five construction risks. And I kind of like, oh, okay, I didn't think on this project it was going to be that bigger thing. So there's some sewage drying beds, historical sewage drying beds, there's a landfill over there, but just all kind of in our world, normal things that we know how to work with and mitigate against and what the requirements are. So I think we've all got, you know, got quite used to working with these things, and there's guidance in place now, thank God. But yeah, I was amazed to find that within such a big, complicated project, top five risk contaminated land was in there. So yeah, it was good, and it was good to see that was in their consciousness. But maybe to them, adding onto a bridge is straightforward, and maybe building a carriageway onto something that's old and not quite secure is fine. But yeah, I think that multi-discipline working together, yeah, we do tie in with, we've got, the way I would see it in a Venn diagram is we've got all of the engineering disciplines here, and then we've got all of the environmental disciplines here, and we quite often are in the middle between both of them, I would say.
Yeah.
Not to blow our own trumpets, sorry.
No, blow that trumpet.
We're the multi and I.
Yeah. So what events have you got coming up to really get those messages out? What's new with Silk?
Well, we've got myself and Ian are presenting at the Silk Annual Forum at the end of March 29th, and we're doing a joint presentation. Actually, we're going to do some case studies on large infrastructure projects and how we apply the land quality principles to those projects around materials reuse and risk assessment and safety. So we've got that coming up again. And then Paul's also speaking at that conference, but I'll let him tell you what the title is.
So I'm going to be exploring whether Marmite meets the UK waste legislation or not. And the context is some of the ridiculous legal definitions of waste that are slowing down house construction, making redevelopment much more expensive and complicated than it needs to be. And we do have a window at the moment to undo an enormous wrong by wrongly defining construction materials and excavated materials as waste, even though they are still usable and useful somewhere else. And that is an enormous bottleneck in building the houses that the country needs, that hopefully we might find a way of persuading a few politicians to change their digital laws for us.
Well, that sounds really interesting and entertaining, but particularly in my experience with in your company today, Paul. Thank you so much for your time today on the podcast. It's been really good fun, and you know, it's helped me learn a lot more about contaminated land. A couple of takeaways: throw away your saucepans if they're scratched. Use somebody, obviously, from the Silk Register if you want to do a contaminated land investigation. Do get in touch. This will be shared on LinkedIn, so get in touch with any comments or questions you might have, or if you just want to tell us what your favourite Mark Wahlberg movie is. It'd be great to hear from you. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you. Take care.